There's actually like there's a happy medium here where sometimes the times can be too patrician and institutional.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Monday, August 24th, which means it's Media Monday. Today, John Kelly and I discuss the uneasy relationship between the New York Times, beholden to the standards of ivory tower journalism, and creator journalists online, in particular, Pablo Torre, who dropped a bombshell report last year about malfeasance inside the Los Angeles Clippers front office. Torre now works for the Times, and his report still hasn't been confirmed by other news outlets. And you gotta wonder if his reporting would have passed muster inside the Times newsroom. We also discuss MS Now making a play for digital subscribers and a new revenue stream and whether their plan can actually work. We'll discuss all that and much more on today's episode of The Powers That Be.
Introducing Intersectors, Legal Perspectives on Global Business, a podcast from White & Case. Hear partners with diverse legal perspectives across practices, industries, and jurisdictions discuss the complex legal, business, and geopolitical issues shaping markets worldwide. Subscribe to Intersectors, that's Inter, S-E-C-T-O-R-S, and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy Monday, everybody, and welcome to the Powers That Be. If it's Monday, it's Media Monday, and I'm, of course, joined by our fearless leader, John Kelly. We're going to talk today about the New York Times' uneasy relationship with the creator, influencer, journalist economy, which is flaring as Pablo Torre's Watergate-style investigation into Steve Ballmer and Kawhi Leonard still hasn't been proven yet. And ESPN actually did some reporting recently that contradicted his very high-profile investigation, which got a lot of clicks, but there are questions about the underpinning journalism there. We're also going to talk about MS Now trying to build a subscriber business. I'm actually a little bullish on this, which might surprise people. We'll see if John is a bear. I assume he might be, but they're trying to build out a kind of digital footprint that people pay for. Anyway, we'll get into that. John, it's good to see you. I was on the couch the other night, flipped on the TV. The Little League World Series is on. Yeah. Do you have a scouting report on the Bayonne, New Jersey youth squad? Do you know about this team?
Yeah, no, they're rapidly advancing, and I think they just took out the Connecticut youngsters to advance their Bayonne, good sports town, Peter. Also, surprisingly, one of the home to one of the nicest country clubs that you'll find in the Northeast. I know you're a big golfer, and you just turned 45, so you're trying to think of some special life moments to create for yourself here. But no, my days of 50-70 baseball are over. We moved on to 60-90 in the real thing.
I'll save it for the Patreon. Your explanation of why Bayonne, New Jersey is a big sports town, but that was a provocative statement on your part. Let's go, speaking of sports, to the ESPN Kawhi Leonard Pablo Torre dust up. Now, Dylan wrote a piece called The Life of Pablo. Good headline, as usual. This was an Inner Circle exclusive. I know this because I tweeted the story, and a lot of people wanted to read it, and they were DMing me being like, yo, dude, can you post a GIF link?
Come whatever. On, anyway, no, you guys
subscribe,
can afford it, trade people. Up.
And we're going to talk really about the importance of subscription business to the future of journalism later. Anyway, I'm going to read you Dylan's lead here. On Monday, that would be last Monday, ESPN reported that the NBA's nearly year-long investigation into the Los Angeles Clippers found no evidence that the team's owner, Steve Ballmer, had secretly funneled money to Kawhi Leonard in order to circumvent the salary cap. The piece, bylined by veteran investigative reporter Don Van Atta Jr. and NBA insiders Baxter Holmes and Ramona Shelburne, seemed to radically alter the trajectory of a scandal that has dogged one of the NBA's top players, cast suspicion on its wealthiest owner, and raised uncomfortable questions about the integrity of the league's economics. Well, it also raised uncomfortable questions about Pablo Torre, Harvard man, yeah. The kind of guy who likes to use the phrase "my journalism" when talking about his investigations into Bill Belichick's girlfriend on his podcast. Look, I want your take on this. I have friends who are friends with Pablo, who like Pablo, and really like Pablo Torre. I like him too. I just think that sometimes on his YouTube show and podcast, he presents his scoops with this like a lot of throat clearing, a lot of sort of like hoity-toity arrogance that I'm doing the big work that mainstream journalists are not in the sports world. You know, they're beholden to the big leagues and the big agents and the big networks. And look, there's a lot of truth to that. And a lot of sports journalism these days should be put in quotes because it's just yelling and not substance. But, you know, my take when I watched his investigation into Steve Ballmer, and the claim was basically that he got a environmental sort of startup company to funnel money to Kawhi Leonard so he could be paid more so that the Clippers could re-sign him. And then if you watch the YouTube show, Pablo came out with this like stack of papers, and it looked like the Warren Commission report, right? It was like this massive thick stack of papers. He's like, I've done all of this investigation, whatever. Look, there's probably some shady dealings out there among owners in all the leagues. I had two notes on that when it came out. One, again, the tone is a little annoying, but if a conservative or a right-wing person like presented, you know, in the manner of Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, like that big like whiteboard chart, like, look, I'm connecting all the dots here, you know, a lot of people in media would be critical of that person. There was a conspiratorial tone to it. Again, it's like, I'm doing the work here in new media that mainstream media isn't. That's fine. But the flip side of it is, or the corollary rather, not the flip side, is that no one else really confirmed the reporting. And that's always something that I look for when a story comes out. And this happens a lot with Trump. You know, I remember that McClatchy story from the first term that some Trump apparatchik went to Europe and did a secret deal with the Russians or something. Like, oh my God, that's a huge story. If the New York Times isn't confirming it, the AP isn't confirming it, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, like if big mainstream media outlets aren't touching your scoop, to me, that's not defending Steve Ballmer, the NBA, or the Clippers. That's like, is there anything here? And are you just presenting this story for your audience, for clout and clicks and building your audience? Look, I'm sure he was might have been on to something, but, you know, and but didn't he win a Peabody for this, John?
Pulitzer,
interesting. Anyway, he works at the New York Times now, and the New York Times has its own standards. And we saw this obviously flare at The Athletic with the Diana Rossini scandal, where they kind of paid her a lot of money and let her do whatever she wanted. I'm sure there are people inside the building at the hallowed New York Times who are uncomfortable with the kind of Pablo Torre style journalism that he is conducting out there on the wide world of the internet.
Yeah, I think this breaks out in a couple of levels, Peter. I don't know Pablo either. I've never met him. I mainly see him through PTI and Morning Joe, where he sort of on both platforms plays an old guy's idea of a young guy, you know, which I think is one of his kind of core skills. That's at least my parasocial interaction with him. And you know, you're right that Ballmer has rejected the reporting, and Kawhi has been traded to Toronto. So it doesn't seem like the Clippers view this as such a existential threat that they can't. I mean, obviously that trade's like being held up right now. And you pointed out that ESPN had the story that basically said like nothing to see here, folks. The NBA had their own issues with the ESPN story, and Pablo, nevertheless, like, you know, he got an audio Pulitzer, which I think is sort of like, you know, the special effects makeup sound design type of, you know, award in that world. And technically, it's his show, and the Athletic licenses it, and so actually, you know, what's interesting to me here is that it's another example of this complex relationship between the Athletic and the Times, and the way the Athletic does business, which it's certainly allowed to do. For whatever reason, the Times company hasn't been able to kind of communicate this effectively. You know, what I surmise happened is that when they bought the business and they collapsed their own sports reporting apparatus, they wanted to really make, you know, the easiest thing to do would just be to ingest the organ, you know, and make the Athletic part of the Times machine. But I think that over time, the Times company realized actually that was in the least best interest of both the Athletic and the Times company and their shareholders. The Athletic doesn't want to market itself as a New York Times company affiliate to LSU audiences, right? Like, I don't think that's a very effective credential. I think the Times actually knows that, and economically, they're incentivized to ensure that that's not the, you know, that they're not, you know, stepping on their own foot. And similarly, like the Times is reporting rules, as Dylan points out in this piece, there, you know, the sort of standards desk, it's just not going to work for The Athletic, where in many cases, like, the stakes are lower and there's a lot more of a gray area. I'm not saying that Pablo was operating correctly here. I think that there's a lot more there's a lot of smoke bomb stuff here necessarily that doesn't necessarily pin the story down. You know, if you notice during the Rossini situation, Peter, the Times sort of PR apparatus kept referring to this as like an Athletic issue, not a New York Times issue. And Dylan sort of, made fun of them a little bit for doing that. But I actually do think that internally, that really is the posture. And it's one of these annoying New York Times nits where they have to operate in a certain way just to kind of placate the internal politics, whereas everyone else is like, dude, why am I reading a Athletic story on NYTimes.com if you guys aren't one and the same thing? But the other side of the coin is that CNBC or Versant doesn't necessarily take the corporate flack if there's something on Rachel Maddow that they don't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned the word standards. I think that's important. I was talking to Dylan a little bit about this the other day. Plenty of new media enterprises, creator journalists out there have broken stories on the left and the right over the years. There's a lot of good journalists out there who are self-starters, who are independent, et cetera. Not all of them are bad and not all of them are good, but the standards note is important as it relates to this Pablo story because, you know, he reported that basically Aspiration, which this is funny, their company's mission was, quote, socially conscious and sustainable banking services and investment products. Ballmer was an investor in this startup, which was backed by a guy who used to work for Bill Clinton. He had invested $50 million in Aspiration, Steve Ballmer. Basically, Aspiration was paying Kawhi Leonard like a stupid, crazy, big like deal to hype this company, and he only did like one ad for it or something like that. So the issue is not that there isn't any there. Like, there could have been some malfeasance somewhere along the chain.
Big difference between
it's
could
have been. It's just that the standards question is the thing. The New York Times would require two sources confirming, three sources confirming. You know, CNN would require two sources confirming. And as much as Pablo has all this, like, stack of paper when he was revealing the scoop, the question is, would it pass muster in the New York Times newsroom? That's just to me the fascinating question here.
Yeah, and it would have been handled differently, right? I think that we've been on this earth long enough to know that there were probably there would have been hedges, there would have been or recommendations for subsequent rounds of reporting or et cetera. And you know what? There's actually like there's a happy medium here where sometimes the Times can be too patrician and institutional.
But it's so?
Right. But it is interesting how they are. You know, they do have this arm's length posture with a lot of these athletic talent, and I think they felt like that. You know, Pablo was someone that they could get a little more comfortable with because of the acclaim for this, but.
Harvard man.
Let's see. Harvard. Oh, yes. As he's quick to point out, let's see what the final verdict is on this Clippers fiasco. Because if he's proven wrong, just at a place like that, there'll be consequences.
It's just the way the story was presented initially. And Pablo kind of tweeted this himself the other day. It's hard to prove wrong, hard to prove right. He's just putting it out there. Let the people decide. There, right? And that's, again, that gets the difference in standards here. John, speaking of the different cultures of the internet versus traditional newsrooms, we're going to talk about MS Now trying to start a digital subscription business and whether it can work when we come back.
Introducing Intersectors, legal perspectives on global business, a podcast from White & Case. Hear partners with diverse legal perspectives across practices, industries, and jurisdictions discuss the complex legal, business, and geopolitical issues shaping markets worldwide. Subscribe to Intersectors, that's Inter, S-E-C-T-O-R-S, and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We've all had those moments where banking slows work down to a crawl, whether it's a complicated international wire payment that requires a manual form or chasing a status update through an outdated clunky portal. That friction isn't just annoying, it costs you real time and mental focus. Banking on Mercury is designed specifically to remove those barriers so you can stay in flow. It offers a powerful, fast experience with free USD wires, same-day ACH, and absolutely no minimum balance requirements. Instead of dealing with five different tools duct-taped together, you get a single smart dashboard where you can see your entire business's health at a glance. It's flexible, collaborative, and allows you to set granular permissions so your team can move fast without you having to micromanage every card swipe. It's banking that actually works for the modern entrepreneur. Visit mercury.com to learn more and apply online in minutes. Mercury is a fintech company, not an FDIC-insured bank. Banking services provided through Choice Financial Group and Column NA, members FDIC. Welcome back to the Powers of Beer, everybody. It's Media Monday. I'm talking to John Kelly. John, we were just discussing the uneasy relationship between traditional media, digital media. You know, MS Now, I guess I wouldn't put under the bucket of like the New York Times as traditional media. They're obviously a partisan network, an ideological network, but they are a traditional television legacy news brand that we talk about all the time. Julie Alexander a few days ago did some reporting on MS Now's attempt to launch a new digital streaming service. I'm going to read from her piece. Mark Lazarus is preparing to launch a streaming service for MS Now, formerly MSNBC, of course, which will run about $8 a month, slightly more than CNN's nascently reborn streaming gambit, but far less than Fox One, which goes for $20 a month. These are some of the things that MS Now membership will include: 24/7 news feed, the same type of supplemental community-driven content that news brands generally rely on to power their direct-to-consumer offerings, some version of a message board, new creator content, opportunities to interact with MS Now's journalists, et cetera, et cetera. So I was obviously extremely skeptical of CNN's attempt to launch a streaming service, in part because they're building out a suite of entirely new shows with their talent, basically adding to the cost pressures that are already negatively facing a network like them. But, you know, MS Now, unlike CNN, is more ideological, as I mentioned. And I think Julia is right that they can at least build something off of the idea that this is a community of like-minded or similar-minded people, viewers, who feel like they have more of a parasocial relationship with the talent, you know, from Rachel Maddow to Chris Hayes, and that they might be willing to pay $8 a month. I don't know. We'll talk more about this. I think the best comp is The Bulwark, which has built a hugely successful business on, you know, anti-Trump content, obviously without the overhead of MS Now or Versant. What's your take on this so far?
You know, I agree with you on the Bulwark point, but I think there's a difference between Bulwark bucks and MS Now bucks. You know, I'm with you that I'm more optimistic than I think a lot of our contemporaries are about the possibility here. Obviously, they should have launched into the space years and years ago if they wanted to be a viable competitor. But what we see now is that the top tier of streaming is, you know, spoken for, right? It's Netflix, it's Disney, it's YouTube, it's, you know, if Warner Bound gets approved, assuming it does, it'll be, you know, HBO Max and Paramount Plus and Apple, depending on what it wants to do. And so we actually have a very sort of unsophisticated, I think, discourse about it in our industry, because the real battle line is playing out at the next tier, which is the dozens and dozens and scores, like, you know, 100 and something sort of niche streaming services that really exist on platforms like Amazon Channels, you know, where you can kind of pull them off a la carte. And in that world, like, yes, MS Now, which is a brand that stands for something, that really stands out on Channels much more so than a kind of generic news app might, more so than I think CNN All Access necessarily would. The challenge, though, as I see it, is cable companies made their mint because they had this fantastic business model where they made a ton of money even when no one was watching. And now they're in an ecosystem when they can only make money really, you know, in the future when people are downloading them and paying their monthly fee. So that's a real, real head fake. And so I think I view this more modestly as, because Lazarus is a very smart guy, I think this is just an attempt to create a new monetization channel around stuff they're already making, right? I mean, they make these shows, they have these podcasts they produce now, their creators are on YouTube, they can repackage them in a lot of ways, and there is an audience that has not discovered MS Now yet, or likes it, knows it, and now they have a chance to bundle it. But I think that the one of the big, you know, sort of one of the notable details around this is we remember when CNN was hawking CNN Plus 5 years ago or so, they were treating it like the second coming of Christ. And this is a much more modest rollout, I think, befitting a very, very different time in the industry.
That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm reason I'm bullish. I'm not suggesting it's going to be this massive standalone business. It just, and Versant's been interesting this way. And I think Dylan has written about this too. They've gotten into, you know, they've got Fandango and whatever golf apps they have. I mean, they're just trying to build out these additional revenue streams based on internet users. And I think there's something like they could build this added tendril in a way that I think CNN could not. Just the, more the partisan community driven thing. I think CNN can figure out ways to monetize either based on, you know, some subs, and, you know, the streaming service should always have been just like a dupe of CNN airtime and not like its own channels. One more note before I let you go. I did bring up the Bulwark, and I kind of take a victory lap on this, not because I'm Tim and I are besties, but like when the Bulwark was being built in 2020, I believe, as this sort of anti-Trump content machine, I remember I pitched Ben Smith when he was the columnist in the New York Times. I was like, this is an interesting business model. And that's not a term the Bulwark would have used, and no one pitched me on it. It was just like they're getting highly engaged partisans and anti-Trump reactionaries to fork over some bucks to read their content on Substack, and not, they weren't as big on YouTube at the time, but, you know, listen to their podcasts or whatever. And Ben was like, I don't get it. And Ben's a friend of mine. This is kind of a funny little like victory lap in hindsight, but Inc. Magazine just did a big profile on the Bulwark, and I think a bunch of places have, but because they have such a community feel, and they invest a lot in touring, like they do these big events, and I've been to some of them, and you have these like rapturous audiences, and the Pod Save America guys do the same thing as well. But these are just some of their numbers that were included in this Inc. Magazine profile. They have annual revenue topping $20 million last year. They're on track to reach $30 million this year. They passed 1 million Substack subscribers, more than 140,000 paid. They have 1.7 million followers on YouTube. Tim has had 70 million views on YouTube last year, which is really annoying to me because like I hear it from my neighbors now and then as we're like, oh, you know Tim Miller? It's like, dude, shut up. And they have like over a million subs, not all of them paid, of course. Anyway, but they're starting, obviously, they launched without the overhead and all the institutional burdens of like a legacy media company.
Yeah.
So I just found that very interesting. And obviously MSNBC is now pumping in Crooked Media, Pod Save America content to fill their airtime too, because that dovetails nicely with their audience. So I do think, again, if you're an ideological media company, it's easier to build subscription businesses. And obviously here at Puck, we are fascinated with the future of subscription businesses. We are not ideological.
No, we are. There's a wrinkle to this though too, Peter, which is that MS Now is probably making, you know, $300-400 million bucks a year. They can't become the Bulwark, you know, like that is the, I think they see that and see that we frame it successfully, which is true. But if a successful partisan or sort of affinity driven media enterprise looks like it's in the tens of millions, then they're in big trouble.
All right, John, the dog days of summer are coming to an end. I will text you during the next Bayonne, New Jersey Little League World Series game. I'm rooting for Alabama myself. See you in the Slack, buddy.
See you in the Slack.
Thanks so much for listening to The Powers That Be, the official podcast of Puck in partnership with Odyssey. I'm Peter Hamby, and I'd like to thank our show's executive producers, Puck co-founder John Kelly, executive editor Ben Landy, and director of editorial operations Gabby Grossman. On the Odyssey side, thanks to Bob Tabador and Chris Basil for their recording, editing, mixing, and mastering, and to executive producers Asha Saluja and Leah Reese-Dennis.